have a seat, everyone.
If you remember, my wife is coming to the rule. I was here last year, and we're not here this year, and I'm just trying to help attend corral the cat. So we're going to be having lunch soon. I don't know if Richard wants to make any upcoming announcements. We're not going anywhere, right?
Yeah, we're staying here.
We're staying here. Just a request, if you'd like to have a hallway conversation with someone, going here, it can be a little bit loud, so if you just go around the corner. Any other sort of announcements of where we are?
No, if you think about your lightning talks for future.
Okay, yes, we have some slots that we're going to talk. So our first keynote speaker will be Clay Shirky. He's written two wonderful books and many interesting blog posts. Seems like you are actively doing that. The most recent is called Cognitive Surplus, which follows the times. Here Comes Everybody. And I don't know what you'll be talking about, but
I'll be talking about that. So, yeah. I'll be talking about that.
Yeah, thank you, Clay.
On behalf of IUP, delighted that this will be here. Sorry about the squeaky floors. Other than that, it seems like a kind of a great space. We're really pleased to be able to host this. I have written a couple of books about social media. I want to talk today about participatory culture, particularly drawn from some of the stuff that's in the book that just came out at the beginning of June on cognitive surplus. And rather than talk about cognitive surplus in the abstract, I'll just start with a story that I think illustrates what I'm talking about better than I could if I just broke it down abstract. So the story begins January 2009, in Bangalore, India. A group of women out of an evening going out for a drink were attacked by men. They were dragged, women were dragged from the pub, they were slapped, they were kicked. Men who tried to intervene were also attacked, as is by now usual, the whole thing is documented on camera phones, photos, and videos, and uploaded and widely viewed. Shortly after the images of these attacks circulated, this guy, Prana Vitala, who's the leader of a Hindu fundamentalist group named Sri Ram Singh, which means basically Lord Ram's army, God's army, said, "We attacked those women because they were not living up to our vision of Hindu womanhood. They were not being sufficiently chaste, they were not being sufficiently private, and our next attack will be on Valentine's Day. You're a woman, and we catch you out of doors on Valentine's Day with a man who's not your blood relative, we will attack you again." So this is the women of the Manuel Brothers, the class of collective action line. They have to decide what to do on Valentine's Day. Each of them can decide to go out in hopes that enough other people will make that same decision so that there's safety in numbers. But there's a risk there because you don't know what other people are going to do. Or each of them can decide to stay home quite reasonably in order not to be attacked, but therefore hand an enormous propaganda victory to Sri Ram Singh. But in 2009, and thanks to tools we all know so well, there was a third option, which is to take on collective action problems collectively. So this woman, Nisha Susan, I apologize for the sliding of the summit window, is not the brightest, but Nisha Susan, who was a journalist working in Bangalore, founded a Facebook group. My favorite Facebook graph is yours too. The Association of Loose Forward and Pub Going Women. The Association of Loose Forward and Pub Going Women, a very popular group, you might imagine, gained thousands of members in its first few days of existence. And their first action was, let's send some underwear to Sri Ram Singh. Was often called shaniwal, as underpants wearers, because they wear sort of khaki shorts that look a little bit like diapers. And so the women of the Association of Loose Forward and Pub Going Women got a bunch of pink underwear and wrote notes to Sri Ram Singh on the back, notes to Prana Vitala on the back, got his address, and mailed him the pink underwear. And of course, the Indian media had a field day. There were several reactions. Immediately, of course, Vitala and Sri Ram Singh said, "Well, this is even worse behavior. We're going to mail those. We're going to send those women back appropriately covering the car." They didn't actually do that, but that's what they said they were going to do. The second thing is that the Indian government decided that in light of the attacks on women suffered, they would arrest Vitala, some of the senior lieutenants of Sri Ram Singh, and they arrested them on February 13th, thus putting them in protective custody over Valentine's Day weekend. and there were no attacks at Valentine's Day. And I believe they said there were no attacks on Valentine's Day in 2010 either. And the third thing that happened, of course, is that the members of the consortium of Blue Sword Quest Going Women realized that they could, if they combined forces, do something that they couldn't have done as individuals. And there is, in both in technological circles and in media, a tendency to cover these stories as if they're technology stories, that this was something that Facebook did. Right? Facebook certainly provided the capability, but the capability that Facebook provided was for Susan to take advantage of a resource that we couldn't get to easily in the 20th century, and we can't get to easily in our little corner of the 21st century, and that resource is coordinated voluntary participation. Right? That's what made the difference between each individual woman deciding, do I stay in or do I go out, and the ability of this group of people to take action as a coordinated. So I have been thinking for some time, as we all have, whether we're as users of the tools or people who study the tools about coordinated voluntary participation, about essentially what is making the changes around coordinated voluntary participation such a big deal right now. And I needed some metric, right? Some way of describing the amount of time and effort and attention that is going into these kinds of collecting problems. And no such metric exists. So I invented one to kind of rough and ready measurement. I mentioned it, of course. Our largest and oldest and most public example of this kind of coordinated effort. I called my friend Martin Wattenberg, who was then at IBM, is now at Google, and who spent a lot of time studying Wikipedia. If you've seen the history flow visualization, you've seen Martin's work. And at the back of the envelope calculation, as of 2008, we figured that Wikipedia in all languages, all the code, all the articles, all the edits, all the talk pages, added up something like 100 million hours of human property. In fact, the envelope calculation was the right order of magnitude. So now we had a unit of voluntary participation. Obviously, anything that takes 100 million hours is a big deal.
Yeah.
How big is that number? How big is that number relative to the total available free time and talent of the connected world? How much potential is there for these types of projects? And so I made the metric for that as well. I took as a proxy television, the number one use of free time worldwide. Right. So imagine all of just the United States of television watching, right, represented graphically. How much time is that? It is 200 billion hours in the U.S. alone every year. Right? Or, put another way, Wikipedia is it. I don't know if you've seen it. That is the entirety of all effort of Wikipedia over the decade relative to a single year of television watching in the United States alone. Worldwide, this number amounts to over a trillion hours a year. Put still another way, in the U.S., we watch a Wikipedia's worth of television every weekend just watching ads. So the potential surplus here, the potential for harnessing this kind of contribution is enormous. And even our largest and oldest project, right, represents just a tiny fraction of that. Right. So every place we look, we see this with Wikipedia, we see this with InstaSushi, we see this with CapSurfing, we see this with Rise Wars. People are taking on problems where adding coordination among the participants is creating a different kind of output than we were able to get. And harnessing this coordinated voluntary participation is leading to all kinds of new things. Right? Projects with incredible artistic, scientific, social aspects. It's also leading, of course, to lots and lots of wallcats. This is also a feature of coordinated voluntary participation. I don't want to make it sound like it's all high money and stuff. Right? And there's lots of hand-wringing right now about the lolcats, right? That, that, you know, is the internet making a stupid kind of thing, because most of the profusion of the media landscape is around this stuff, right? It's around taking cute pictures of cats and making them even cuter with the addition of cute captions. That's the work that a lot of our free time is being put to. But not only captions. That's the thing about media revolution, right? When we got the printing press, the sacred printing press, the medium that thou shalt not criticize, we got erotic novels, bang, first crack down the box, right? The Venetians set up a printing press and somebody goes, hey, I know. Scientific journals? Took another 150 years more to have that idea. Right? So when we look backwards, we see the whole thing, and it's as if, oh, it all happened about 1450. No. Right? It took a long time from the invention of the printing press to harnessing it, not just for, you know, the obvious things, but harnessing it for real cultural change. So this is now our moment in time, right? Which is, we're in a culture where we suddenly have a medium that allows for much wider participation among much more coordinated groups than we've ever had before. We get the lolcats first cracked out of the box because that's the kind of thing that happens. But working out the cultural norms that lead to something like scientific journalism, essentially trying to figure out what culture is needed to create something that much lasting value. That's a hard job. Right? And it's not like the other stuff then goes away. We'll always have lolcats or some approximation. Right? The question I think we face sort of as a group is, what else can we do with the media other than the stuff that's already happening? Where are the places where we can actually think about the cultural norms that are needed to create something? It is a curiosity of our current era. And I don't know if we'll ever know if it was a coincidence or if there's something deep going on. But right now, sociology, psychology, economics are increasingly telling us stories about human behavior that are related to the kind of participatory efforts that we continue to rely on. The neoclassical story of human behavior in the 20th century was, we're all individual, rational, self-interested actors who are operating essentially to maximize our own good, and we can model the world as if it was a market. And over again, we're now seeing evidence that that's not true, that people have deep intrinsic desires and ways of dealing with one another that aren't selfish, that aren't purely self-motivated, that do involve some kind of commitment to a cultural norm. I want to tell you one story from that scientific literature that I think illustrates some of the issues in thinking through trying to get this culture right. And it's a story from a paper, beginning part of the second, by Yuri Nizzi and Alfredo Rusticini. It's called The Find of the Person. And Nizzi and Rusticini essentially set out to test this hypothesis, this idea of whether or not you can model people's behavior as actors operating in a contractual market. And so they went to Israeli data research. They studied 10 Israeli data research. And they studied those data research at the moment of highest tension, which is pickup time. Because at pickup time, the teachers have been with your kids all day, and they would like you to be there at the appointed hour to pick them up. Meanwhile, parents, caregivers, baby at work, running errands, would like a little slack to pick their kids up. So Nizzi and Rusticini said, how often do parents pick their kids up late in these 10 days? So they spent the first 5 weeks of the study just trying to answer that question. They divided the daycare centers into two roughly equal groups. The squares are the control group, the diamonds are the experimental group. And between 6 and 12 late pickups a week. So then they said, okay, we're going to change this behavior as of right now. We're going to test something called deterrence theory, which is if you want people to do less of something, add a fine or add a punishment. If you want people to do more of something, take the punishment away. So the way to test the deterrence theory, they went to they went to the daycare center to listen and block, they turned the block down. And they said, okay, as of right now, parents, if you pick your kids up more than 10 minutes late, we're going to fine you 10 shots. That's it. It's going to be added to your bill automatically, no ifs, ands, or buts. And the minute they implemented that contract, the behavior of those daycare centers changed. Late pickups went up every week for the next 4 weeks until they topped out and tripled the pre-fine average, and then bounced back and forth between double and triple the pre-fine average. So here's the case where you've added a punishment, you've added contractual punishment, and made the charging behavior worse. Because what do the parents think? The parents think that once they pay their 10 shekels, right, that their whole duty to the daycare center has been discharged. I don't need to worry about feeling guilty, I don't need to worry about how the teachers are feeling, all of that stuff is gone. It's now been rolled up into a contract and a price. Very good. And the parents' reaction is quite reasonably, 10 shekels. Take my kid away, welcome me back. And so you see this graph. This graph is a graph of a culture breaking. Right? The contract broke the culture. In sort of neoclassical, if those daycare centers were operating without a contract, they were operating without any constraints at all. But what we can see here is that they had constraints, just the constraints were cultural. Right. There was a loose bargain, there was a kind of understood agreement, no one had ever written it down, but everybody clearly kind of understood it. And then in one group, they changed the rules and the culture changed. The other group, obviously, nothing much, was different across a whole range of people. They run this experiment for 12 weeks, line break the culture, the parents are now encouraged to view the teachers as instrumental agents of their financial will and not the fact that people who are in partnership raising their kids. And then you need to say, okay, that's for us, that's for raising experiment. All done with that. You tear up the contract, no more fun. You know, the really interesting thing happened. Nothing changed. Not only did adding the fine break culture, but removing the fine didn't unbreak it. Which is to say, cultures are organic things that can't be flipped on and flipped off when you want. And if you break the culture, it's not enough to just say, oh, my bad, I'm just going to reverse course. Right? You would have to do something. So let's bring you back to law.
And for the involuntary participation.
The law test, the thing that happens just when you get a meeting like this, people are going to use it to crack each other up. If I live that, I'd sort of call it a let it happen. That's just what we get for having something like internet, you know, having something like that. I like law cats as much as the next guy. But I have a hard time looking into the future and imagining a world where someone has to say to themselves, where on the internet can I find a picture of a cute cat? That strikes me as being a largely solved problem. On the other hand, when we look back at previous media revolutions and we see cultures like the original chemist who invented the idea of a scientific journal, the Invisible College in London in the 1600s, that's not the kind of thing that just happened. That was a group of people who said, we're going to take this printing press thing and we're going to build some cultural norms around it, like openness and peer review. And we're going to take that combined capabilities of the printing press and the cultural norm, and we're going to do something. The scientific revolution would not have been possible without the printing press. But the printing press did not cause the scientific revolution. You've got to hold both beliefs in your head at the same time to see how the cultural. I put that on the make it happen spectrum. That's not the kind of thing that we get just as a side effect of having the internet and having the web. That's something that only comes about when a group of people say, we're going to take these tools, this raw capability, and press it into service for something that's hard to get, hard to do, but worthwhile. Not just cracking each other up at coffee break, but actually kind of building. And what would you be? Put it in the middle. Where is it on the spectrum? Right.
if you wanted to make the maximum let it happen argument, when Ward Cunningham put up the original wiki in 95, it was for a group of programmers who were sharing information about pattern language, about ways of thinking about the code. And it was a small group of people who basically trusted each other and who all had similar ideas, the so-called Portland pattern model. And to the degree that wikis, the idea of wikis have gone from huh to everybody assumes that collaborative editing by groups is just a thing we're capable of, in less than 10 years, the idea of collaborative editing is now down there. The other hand, the cultural norms, the kind of cultural norms that we would care about if we want to take wikis in general, collaboration, Wikipedia specific, and make it as important to the culture as I think a lot of us in this room think it can be. That's not a let it happen. That's a make it happen. To do that, we need to take work like Joe Riegel's, like Steve Weber's, like Andrew Lee's, what they're telling us about the culture and the cultural norms of whole Wikipedia together, and figure out ways to heighten those, to do the kinds of things that don't happen unless there's good people. You can see some of those ideas going in here, just looking at the board. Is Wikipedia too conservative? Right? The question that came up earlier of, do we want outreach so we can reach into, for instance, people who know more about the Kill a Mockingbird than we're just getting out of this group? If we want people to know more about the fashion industry, people who remember the Cuban Missile Crisis because they were alive, people who speak Swahili, that's not in the main, that's not in the let it happen edge here. That really is sort of imagining cultural change. The gentleman who said that my article's flag is being of minor importance is that it happened on day one, there would not have been a day two, that's exactly the kind of cultural observation that I think is needed up here to make it happen. So I think a lot of the work that's coming up, Wikipedia specific, Wiki culture, collaborative culture in general, around coordinated voluntary participation, it's going to be around the voluntary part. We're relatively good at the technology to coordinate people's efforts. The idea that collaboration would just be I put up something and somebody else copy edits me, right? Dealing with those kinds of technical issues, there's still work to be done, but that work is going. And we're relatively good at giving the individual the capabilities to do their own work, right? Everything from the new editing panel to concern with sort of help. But the voluntary, the motivation part, the part that makes someone want to do it, in spite of the difficulty, it will never not be difficult to work with other people. Right? Other people are super annoying. For evidence of this, I refer you to your own wife. The pleasure of being able to do something completely on your own can only be offset if there are rewards we get for working with each other that can't be got working with each other. And the thing that makes that worth doing is this voluntary piece. So I will end by saying, that the cultural changes that we've seen Wikipedia create already, and I think the kind of cultural change we can imagine if we want it to be of rising quality across an increasing range of high quality articles, isn't just a technological problem. In the same way that Aisha Susan didn't just use Facebook and then Facebook gave her the ability to do this, she met Facebook with something that said, I'm going to use humor as a cultural norm to take on this very serious social problem. Right? We now cumulatively have a medium where the technology has certainly proved itself out and where the culture as it exists has built this incredible edit. I mean, really, in less than 10 years, it went from a desperation move by the Wikipedia folks to being the most important reference for the planet. And yet, there are still places where we can see that we still, let's see a gap between what we've got and what we have. As of increasing the number of people who know about the fashion industry. Remember, the Cuban Missile Crisis speaks about the Atlantic. And those changes, I think, are not going to be technological. Those changes are going to be cultural. Thank you very much.
There's lunch here? I think I heard it alive, actually.
Richard?
Yeah.
Do we have time for questions? Do we go to lunch?
Well,
you
guys
take
a little while to get
one. Okay. So I'll moderate some questions. Richard, no, yeah. I mean, Owen said.
Okay. If you could say your name, please. Do we have any concerns about the cameras?
Yeah, you can use the mic if you want.
Is there a floating one?
Yeah.
Is there a mic right there? Okay, perhaps you come up to the mic and I don't have to moderate it.
Or I'll have
it's not going to go very far, though.
Not violent.
So, for the sake of the camera, if you'd like to ask a question, please come over.
Right, yeah.
Say your name, Tom.
I'm Tom Longhouse, and I have a question. I work on a project that's looking at the wiki tools that were developed by Wikipedia to see if they work in neighborhoods in New York City.
Uh-huh.
So that everybody in New York can kind of contribute to a neighborhood project. Just dumping in everything they know, what their parents knew, whether they're reading books, whatever. And I'm wondering if you think there, if you have any thoughts on whether that might work and what might contribute to people engaging in such a project.
Yeah. So those are two different questions. I'll answer the latter one first. Something I didn't talk about here, but that is, I think, really, really relevant from behavioral economics and sort of related field. Is this list of intrinsic desires that people are appealing to in order to get these projects going, right? We in the 20th century, the story was, we like being office drones and couch potatoes. We kind of figure it between those two modes. And the surprise has been, oh, look, when you give people a meeting where they can create and share, not just consume, they actually take you up on it. And that's even 15 years in, there are people who are still shocked that people are creating and sharing things with their friends. The motivations that seem to lead to that creating and sharing can be broadly divided into two categories, personal and social. The personal motivations that are often the fourth question are autonomy and confidence, the desire to feel in control and the desire to feel good at what you do. And so if you're appealing to people to either work on these tools or to use these tools, an appeal to autonomy, an appeal to confidence often get people involved in the first place. Either you know everything, like you're sort of the mayor of the block, you know the history of the park, you know what books the kids should be reading, why don't you come do that? And also, right, just the intoxicated feeling that we've all felt, hey, I'm just going to edit this page and then look, I did something and the world responds. The social motivations, two of the ones that often come before these projects are a sense of membership and a sense of generosity, a part of a group of people that recognizes me and cares that I'm here, and my actions are benefiting others in ways that they recognize. These things are in some tension. I don't mean to suggest that this is just a laundry list, right? Because plainly, for example, competence and membership are in some tension because if other people are coming in and showing you how to do stuff you don't know how to do, get more confident, which is good, but you're doing it at the price of realizing you were less confident before. So it's a bit of a mix. But I would just as a starter case, ask yourself, anything you're asking people to do, does it appeal to any of those four intrinsic desires, autonomy, confidence, membership, and generosity, and can I harness or heighten that? As to whether it will work or not, you know, I mean, I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about the judge, but we're still in a world of special cases, right? I mean, it's so frustrating to me, anyway, and there may be other people who've gotten past this, but I'll see something, you know, go by on Slackshot or whatever, trying to do something new, and I look at it and I say, boy, I hope that works, but who knows? There's no recipe, right? And if you, I actually have a slide I show my students, which includes, among other things, Larry Sanger's first note.
to the new Freedom Airlines about what became with the media. There's no way you would have read that. That's going to be a real thing. Like, that's the thing that's going to drive Jakarta out of business in 6 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, oh, humor me. This is going to take 5 or 10 minutes. Just try it. Right? So first of all, I would say, since the answer is who knows, why not try it? Because it's a good idea. And as a New Yorker, I'm especially interested. But the other thing I'd say is the culture of observing what the users actually do is so missing from the tech community generally. Right? Right now, we have a culture of user observation which says about once every 18 months, out of a sense of duty, I'll convene some focus group or whatever to watch people through a glass window. And then I'll spend 18 months either using that mental model or ignoring it because those users seem so stupid that I can't believe it and I'm going to pay no attention to it. If I could do anything for tech culture in general, but wiki culture in particular, I would make it very low cost to see what people are actually doing. Meetup down the block over here does user testing every day. Every afternoon they bring somebody off the street and watch them try to use it. And it's just a kind of daily reminder of what it's actually like to take a civilian and say, oh, a super confusing thing is going to happen when you click the edit button. Like, brace yourself, because it's going to look like the screen threw up for a minute, and then you'll be able to, you know. So what I would say is, instead of trying to do some high-cost focus group or whatever, just have three people over your living room who like you but aren't techie.
If you know any people like that, and that's more of a problem in our little ghetto. But if you know people who you like but aren't techie, and just literally ask them to try to do something.
Because the shorter and cheaper we can make the feedback loop of, here's what we think the users think is a good idea, what do the users think? The more we can get the minor irritants out of the right way and see what the big kind of cultural issues are.
Yeah, so the other thing I would add to that actually is if you can envision a short-term gain, that's a good way to bootstrap. I mean, if someone had said, we're going to create an encyclopedic project with dozens of sub-projects, hundreds of millions of articles, people would say you're crazy, but the utility of 10 useful articles has some utility even if it's small. And so look for that short-term gain.
Let me add, Eric Raymond called that in Digital Bizarre the plausible promise. Right? And Linus did this too with Linux. It was just, oh, but I want to make something that's a little bit like Linux that runs on a PC. It wasn't, I want to take over the server market and then run the cloud when it gets here. It was really just, I'd like to make an operating system like Linux. So if you can come up with a plausible promise that says, wouldn't you like to know more about the restaurants in your neighborhood, or even what the public bathrooms are in New York? And get to the big project that Joe said by showing sort of small increments of
that. Hi. Ooh, very well. My name is Jerome Friend. I just came up with what I think is a better question than what I was thinking about before. But I'm vaguely involved in the semantic web world, which you might have heard about. And there's actually a sort of same conflict. I guess you could call it the difference between let it happen and make it happen. A grassroots sort of bottom-up kind of approach versus the top-down instinct, cheating, ontology, and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if you have any thoughts specifically about that. If not, I can go to the other one.
The closest I've ever gotten to death threats, actually, was criticizing the semantic web.
in the early part of this decade, and the narrow utility, from my point of view, the narrow utility of instantiating ontologies is so dramatically offset by the cultural cost that we design that unless you're in a position where either there really is an ontology underneath, like the periodic table of the elements, love that one, that worked out pretty good. But no sociologist, has ever been able to do the same thing. And the notion, so first of all, I think the notion of an upper-merged ontology is fantasy. But the cultural cost of trying to do periodic tables of the elements, things that aren't periodic tables of the elements, is often not worth the cost. I would refer you to the low utility of the taxonomy on Wikipedia, right?
some, you know, sort of banging around in the categories in the bottom, but the bulk of the traffic doesn't come from there, and whether it's the cost benefit trade-off turns out or not, it's not clear, but certainly the utility is low relative to other ways, like CERT.
But I think maybe most important, very often people who set out
with the idea of an ontology don't imagine changing their own mind as often as they imagine imposing their visibly and objectively correct view of the world on infidels, whoever the infidels are.
And those kinds of disagreements cannot be adjudicated. So, to the degree that the semantic web is anything going to be anything more than a sort of got milk campaign for metadata, it seems to me that it almost has to do with Google has done, for example, which is pull the signal from the noise with very large amounts of data, rather than saying we're going to take how the world really is and put that in that sand and sort of all of the issues. You know, the answer to that data is more data observations has turned out to be true over and over again in ways that I think have started people. Peter Norvig, he had search quality at Google, which is a pretty good thing to have in the business world. Now I think he's senior scientist, right? He worked on linguistics on machine translation. It turns out the algorithms that they had in the 80s, which were failing like mad, when they would try them on a corpus of a million words, right? One of the things I learned at Google is that a trillion is a different kind of number than a million. When they took those same algorithms and they threw them against a corpus of a trillion words, they get very good machine translation because the noise is small. So when you look at the bottom of stuff like that, I think that the places where intelligence works are going to be relatively limited, and by and large, we're going to deal with the best of them.
Thank you. So I noticed that some very long sandwiches are arriving. Is Richard here?
Richard.
Are we going to go half an hour for lunch, or should we start lightning talks at 1:15? Okay, so
I
think we should thank Clay. And the facilities, and we're going to get a data for lunch, and we're going to make an announcement at 1 o'clock.